morning. The last case on the court's oral calendar this morning is Irwin Butler versus Makata Trucking and Department of Employment and Economic Development. We're ready for arguments. If counsel for appellant would please approach the podium and introduce yourself for the record before you begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Richard Swenson, here representing the relator appellant, Mr. Irwin Butler. This is, as the court's aware, an appeal from an administrative law judge of the Department of Employment and Economic Development denying Mr. Butler unemployment benefits. I think it's important to understand the procedural history of the case before the administrative law judge. Mr. Butler was dump truck driver for Makata Trucking, the respondent. He was involved in an accident on October 9th of 2017, wherein the box of his dump truck was elevated and struck the underpass of Interstate 35 just outside of Carlton, Minnesota, south and west of Duluth. Mr. Butler was terminated from his employment due to that accident. The employer also cited some other reasons, but as I will point out in a moment, those other reasons didn't have any bearing on the decisions of the administrative law judge below. He was, in essence, primarily or exclusively discharged, according to the record, because of this accident. Mr. Butler applied for his unemployment benefits. He was denied. He then appealed that denial and asked for a hearing. The hearing was set before the administrative law judge, and on April 5th, and the administrative law judge issued her decision after hearing testimony from Mr. Butler as well as the owner of Makata Trucking. And some other documentary evidence, the administrative law judge found that Mr. Butler had been terminated for reasons other than misconduct under the applicable statute. She also specifically found that Mr. Butler had followed all of the appropriate protocols when he dumped his load from his dump truck. He had gotten out and inspected the truck to make sure that the box was empty and that the box was down. He got into the truck and made sure that all the levers and operating gear was in the proper positions. And then he took off from the site where he dumped his load. Now, it was, according to the record and the testimony, it was a bumpy road out of this area where he dumped his load and then onto a gravel dirt road, which is, again was very bumpy, and then onto a county road for a short distance before his box struck the underside of Interstate 29 of an overpass.
Now, as I recall the testimony, and you're describing, I think, the first evidentiary hearing at this point. Right. Mr. Butler did testify as to what he guessed might have been the cause for the box raising.
That's correct.
And what was that?
What Mr. Butler thought perhaps had happened, he was aware, or claims at least, that there were some mechanical or electrical problems that resulted in some fires on the underside of this truck, and that's what he testified to.
And there was other evidence about that in subsequent hearings. Some debate between witnesses as to whether that was the same truck or a different dump truck.
Right.
Which I don't think we have a finding from the ULJ on one way or the other. But the point I think was the theory that Mr. Butler brought forward was the idea that this was somehow an electrical cause. Right. That led to the box being raised.
That's the only reason.
Unbeknownst to him.
Yes, Your Honor. That's the only reason that he could come up with. He had no.
And so in this appeal, you raise two issues, as I read your brief. You know, one has to do with the basis for the ULJ's finding and the role of the Alford plea, and the second has to do with the ULJ's decision not to give Mr. Butler an additional evidentiary hearing after, because there were two full evidentiary hearings, I think, or at least two hearings in which there was additional testimony taken.
That's correct, Your Honor. We're asking this court to remand this case back to the administrative law judge for a further hearing to allow Mr. Butler to present expert testimony, an independent expert witness, to determine if there's any way that this box could have elevated without his negligence or his agency causing that box to elevate. He says he maintains and has maintained consistently through both hearings that he did nothing to cause that box to be raised, and that it was down and all of the mechanical levers were in the proper position when he left the dump site. So how the box was elevated,
I appreciate that, you know, the ULJ was confronted with two different versions of why the box raised, but the judge's final decision, it reads this way, says that Butler testified that the truck malfunctioned because of an electrical malfunction, which caused the truck bed to raise after he left the dump site. This is not credible. I think it's pronounced Locken or Loken. Mr. Loken's testimony provided reliable testimony that the truck bed operated on an air-based hydraulic system, which is not connected in any way to the electrical system. And as I read the testimony of Mr. Locken, his testimony does say that. And so, in this court's standard of review is normally that is, you know, if there is evidence in the record to support the ULJ's findings, you know, that's generally sufficient. And I guess I'm struggling with your second argument. So then, why would an additional evidentiary hearing be required? Of course, you know, if Mr. Butler had come to the second hearing with the testimony you describe, I assume it would have been received by the ULJ. But why should he get a chance to do that, you know, after losing the decision? I guess that's my.
Your Honor, I'd ask Your Honor to look at the both the application that Ms. Locken, the employer, made for this second hearing, and what she says that she's.
But I understand your argument on that. That sort of, you know, sense of fairness. The employer got a second chance, so Mr. Butler should have too. But the difference being the employer did describe evidence that was then submitted in the second hearing, and Mr. Butler did not. I mean, he could have done the same thing.
Well, I would point out to the court that Mr. Butler did introduce evidence at the second hearing that there is another possible cause for this box being elevated. Ms. Locken's first of all, it's her husband, and that's in the record.
Right, right.
I mean, he's not.
And the ULJ was aware of that. That was brought out in testimony.
Not a totally disinterested party or a witness. We subpoenaed all of the repair records for this truck, and there is an interesting fact that emerges when you look at those repair records, that this is, as testified to by Ms. Locken's husband, the mechanic, this is an hydraulic system, and he maintains that there's no way that it can elevate by itself, again, absent negligence on the part of the driver or some overt act, agency on the part of the driver, causing it to raise. But the repair records show that over the previous 6 months prior to this accident, especially during the last 3 months leading up to this accident, there were increasing amounts of hydraulic fluid that had to be put back into the system. There was leakage of hydraulic fluid, and it was getting worse.
So what does the record testimony tell us about that leakage in terms of the cause of the box going up?
Well,
I don't see anything.
Your Honor,
it's just speculation, isn't it, from your side?
Basically, we have, on the part of the employer, it's a res ipsa argument. But for the negligence of the driver or the agency of the driver, this box would not have gone up. there's conflicting evidence, in our view, in the record as to why this box was elevated. The employer is saying that it's the employee that caused the box, either through negligence or overt action, to be raised. The employee is saying, I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not an expert. I don't know what the reason is. There is some evidence in the repair records of this truck that it was leaking hydraulic fluid, which may be the reason for it. And all we're asking for is the opportunity to present expert testimony as to whether or not there is some possibility or a possibility that hydraulic leakage or some other cause might cause this box to go up.
Did you actually identify an expert who was willing to come in and provide that testimony?
Not until after this hearing. And this goes back to the reason the judge gave for granting this second hearing. She said that she was going to, well, first of all, the employer said that the employer was going to provide statements from a mechanic, foreman relating to a prior accident that she didn't. She offered no testimony at the second hearing regarding that. And then she said that she would offer testimony from the DOT or others concerning why this box malfunctioned or why it was up anyway. At the hearing, we subpoenaed the DOT and Highway Patrol woman who testified. They had taken some pictures, but they didn't take any pictures of the interior of the truck. Their inspection was cursory, didn't really inspect to see if there were any problems with it. It was a very cursory inspection. And then they ticketed Mr. Butler for driving over a truck over minimum height or maximum height. So we're asking for it. The employer's not going to be prejudiced by another hearing.
Mr. Swenson, just your description there of the reason, though, would that not have, between the first and second hearing, put your client on notice that the issue will be, why did the box go up? Hence, that would have been your time to find the expert to be prepared to testify.
Well, Your Honor, we didn't think, first of all, she didn't present any expert testimony the second hearing. She introduced an employee of hers and her husband to testify that there wasn't any way that this could happen except for the negligence of the driver. In her order...
Before you finish your argument, I just appreciate that it goes quickly, and you do have rebuttal time, so if you want to explore this in your rebuttal, you can do that as well. I just want to make sure that we acknowledge that the ULJ actually found that Mr. Butler, had two acts of negligence here. So one involves what was the cause of the box being up, but the other is, why didn't he see the box up? You know, why is he sufficiently checking his mirrors and aware of what was going on? Because, of course, we all are aware of the sequence here. His vehicle struck a power line before it went under the bridge, and he acknowledged that he was unaware of having struck the power line with the box. So you haven't addressed that aspect of his of the negligence finding.
Your Honor, his testimony was consistent throughout, and his testimony didn't change. The only fact that was introduced in the second hearing that changed was the testimony of the husband of the owner of Mikada. That's really the only relevant testimony not the only relevant testimony, because there was also the testimony concerning the leaking.
Well, and I may not be being very clear in my question, Mr. Swenson. Here's what I'm trying to suggest is, even if everything you say about the cause of the box going up is true, based for all the reasons you've articulated, there is this other act of negligence, the employee's own failure to take due care and be aware that the box was up and therefore going to hit this overpass. So we don't really have to get into the cause of the box being up.
I would just argue, Your Honor, that the driver, Mr. Butler, testified at both hearings, but I specifically remember the first hearing, that he did check his rearview mirrors, that he did...
But the judge The ULJ found otherwise, and I think there's evidence in the record to support her conclusion.
What we're really, well, the two decisions are inconsistent, obviously, in their factual findings. Very inconsistent. The only fact, new fact, that she really could rely on in making the second decision was the testimony of the mechanic, the husband of the employer. It was nothing else that was new in the second hearing, as far as evidence was concerned, again, with the exception of the additional evidence about the leakage of hydraulic fluid. So we still have a mystery here as to why this box went up. And Mr. Butler says he checked his rearview mirrors. He did everything appropriately. She found that in the first hearing. I'll address some other issues on rebuttal. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, Counsel. Do you need to adjust the podium? You can if necessary.
I probably do, Your Honor.
There should be a button in front below that will lower it for you.
In the front of
the podium.
Oh, I see.
There you go.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Muneza Humayun, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development in this matter. We respectfully ask the Court to affirm the ULJ's decision because her findings of fact in her August 20th, 2018 decision are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and her decision is legally correct. In addition, the ULJ did not abuse her discretion when she denied the request by Mr. Butler to grant an additional hearing after the August 20th decision was issued. I would like to start by just addressing a point that Your Honor, Judge Bratwell brought up. I think there were actually three hearings on three separate days, and these were spread out over a period of four months. The first hearing was held April 5th, 2018. The second one was July 17th. The third one was August 8th, 2018. And at each of those hearings, of course, Mr. Butler was represented. I would like
evidence was taken at all three hearings.
I'm sorry?
Evidence was taken at all three hearings. I think
yes.
The last one, you're refreshing my memory.
Yes.
Last one had to do with the DOT witness, isn't
correct.
That right? Okay, thank
the,
you.
The State Patrol officer, Officer Deinhardt, testified at the last hearing only.
Right.
I would just like to start by addressing the ULJ's findings of fact, including her credibility determination.
I appreciate that you're starting there, and I want to be specific about my concern. So we have a ULJ that's saying that in the findings, and I'm just reading from the addendum at 11, that Butler's Alford plea relating to the accident supports a finding that Butler was responsible for the truck bed being up at the time he hit the bridge. And your brief is pretty circumspect on that point. You pretty much seem to acknowledge that that was error for the ULJ to, I think, receive into evidence the record of conviction. And that's what I wanted to ask you. What was the ULJ's error?
It seems that there were two errors there, Your Honor. First, the Alford plea, by its very nature, does not include an admission of guilt. So it does not make sense to admit it as evidence of substantive responsibility or negligence. And I think the other issue there was that the statute to which Mr. Butler entered the plea of violation was a strict liability statute. It seemed to only have two elements. One was that he operated a motor vehicle, and two, that the motor vehicle height total exceeded 13.5 feet. So we concede that it was error, but as we pointed out in our brief, it was harmless error because the ULJ did have enough evidence apart from the Alford plea to support all of her findings. And
so you don't mention the fact that under Minnesota statutes, a record of conviction is not admissible evidence for any purpose in a civil case. I assume that applies to proceedings before a ULJ. It's a civil proceeding, right?
It is a civil proceeding, Your Honor. The rules of evidence do not apply as strictly in administrative proceedings.
This isn't a rule of evidence. This is a statute.
I understand that, Your Honor. And it was error for the ULJ to rely on and to admit the Alford plea into evidence. But if you review the entirety of the record and her findings, you will find
How do we find it's not prejudicial error if the judge uses it to find that, and I'm just reading her, the ULJ's finding, Butler was responsible for the truck bed being up at the time he hit the bridge?
Correct, Your Honor. And before she gets to that sentence, she does explain that she believed the employer witness's testimony overall. And if you look at Mr. Larkin's testimony, he testified very firmly that if Mr. Butler had in fact put the bed down before he started driving, there was absolutely no way for it to have risen on its own without him doing anything, which was Mr. Butler's claim. So the only inference to be drawn from the totality of the evidence, even if you completely disregard the Alford plea, was that Mr. Butler must not have put the bed down before he started driving after he leaving the gravel pit. And she explains specifically in her first paragraph under reasons for decision that she that Mr. Larkin provided reliable testimony that the truck bed operated on an air-based hydraulic system, which is not connected in any way to the electrical system. She also said that the employer witnesses' testimony and written submissions were supported by public records. They were corroborated by multiple witnesses, and they were more logical overall. And again, if you review only Mr. Larkin's testimony, I think that by itself is sufficient to support each of the factual findings about the negligent omissions that Mr. Butler made.
So you're basically saying that if the Alford plea is taken out of the analysis, there's sufficient evidence in the record to support the ULJ's determination.
Exactly,
do I understand
Your
Honor. You right?
That is our argument. And as you mentioned earlier, Your Honor, when you were questioning counsel, it's not just what caused the box to go up. It's not just who was responsible for the box being up in the first place. There's also subsequent negligence by Mr. Butler. He drove for more than a quarter of a mile with the box up and failed to notice that the box was up. He claimed that he was looking in his mirrors, but there's no way that he would have missed it if he had, in fact, checked his mirrors even once in that quarter-mile drive.
Does the record reflect how far Mr. Butler drove from the time he hit the power line until the time he hit the overpass?
I believe the record says that it was one long block between the power lines being hit and the bridge.
And, of course, that distance, one long block, we all use it, but it doesn't seem to mean anything very specific.
Right. I don't believe there was any more specific evidence about the distance. In addition, Ms. Holmes, the Mikado owner, also testified that she was told by the MnDOT investigators at the scene that when Mr. Butler hit the power line, he would have felt a jolt. And if not, at the very least, he would have seen in his mirrors that he had to hit the power lines. And again, he seemed shocked when he was told later on that he had hit the power lines. So it's a series of negligent omissions. First, he doesn't get out of the truck and make sure that the box is down before he starts driving. Then he gets on the road and does not check his mirrors for, it seems, several minutes while he's driving for more than a quarter of a mile, hits power lines again, is not being vigilant like he's supposed to be, like he's been told to be by the owner of the company multiple times in the past, including after his May 2017 accident.
Does the record show, I'm curious, perhaps more than anything, I'm assuming from, this is a rural area, so from the point when he dumped the load to hit a power line to where he, when he hit the underpass, he stalled, the truck stopped, as I understand it. There must have been, I was curious how anybody knew he hit a power line. There's no one around, and there must have been no co-workers as well, that they must not have a process that, hey, you know, to call up your truck is, your, none of that.
Right, and it's not clear from what I could tell from the record, Your Honors. It did seem that by the time Ms. Holmes learned about the accident having occurred, and by the time she made it onto the scene, people were already working on repairing the power line. So apparently sometime between when he hit the power lines and when she got to the scene, which was, I think, shortly after she was notified around 6:30 p.m. on that day, somebody must have noticed that there must have been either a noise or something that alerted people nearby that something had happened.
Interruption of power, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct.
And so the bottom line, though, is it was right after the second ticket. He never reported back to work. The policy that he had one earlier that year, and now this one, and that was the reason for the discharge.
Correct. The employer testified that their policy is, after two accidents in which the employee is found to be at fault, it's automatic termination, and they have to be held to that because the employee is uninsurable after that, as Mr. Butler was in this case. And I also want to point out something that that counsel mentioned in his brief. He said that the ULJ left her factual findings about the May 2017 accident undisturbed in her second decision. That is not correct, because under the statutes governing reconsideration, 268.105, subdivision 2 and 3, if the ULJ orders an additional hearing on reconsideration and then issues a new decision and findings of fact, the prior decision and findings of fact are set aside. So those earlier findings of fact about what Mr. Butler may or may not have done about the May 2017 accident, those may not as well exist. I mean, they are void. They have no legal effect for purposes of this proceeding. So the only findings of fact that matter are the ones in the August 20, 2018 decision, which the ULJ then upheld on reconsideration. I also wanted to point out, Your Honors, that on this issue of requesting a hearing to present expert testimony, if you look at the first hearing and Mr. Butler's counsel questioning his own client and making his closing argument, and I'll point you to the exact pages. It's pages 63 through 65 of the transcript, and his closing argument is on pages 78 and 79. His theory from the very beginning was that some malfunction in the truck caused the bed to rise. So Mr. Butler, who was represented throughout the proceedings from day one, knew going in that that was going to be his argument. And yet at no time did Mr. Butler or counsel request that the ULJ continue the hearing to allow them to obtain an expert. At the beginning of each of the April 5th and July 17th hearings, the ULJ reminded the parties that the hearing was the only opportunity to present evidence and other testimony and other evidence on the issue, which was whether this was employment misconduct. She also reminded the parties that there's no burden of proof in these hearings, and that the parties had the right to request that the hearing be rescheduled to obtain witnesses or documents by subpoena if necessary. And Mr. Butler's counsel did request subpoenas of witnesses and documents, and those were all granted. Every single request by Mr. Butler's counsel was granted by the ULJ. So at no point was a continuance requested to obtain an expert, and there's no showing of good cause. There's no showing that likely false evidence submitted at the hearing affected the outcome, other than pointing out that Mr. Locken happens to be married to the owner of the company. Counsel has not pointed to any deficiency in his testimony. He does point out that there was hydraulic fluid that seemed to be added to this truck at close intervals leading up to the accident, and I was trying to find the exact page where there was a response by the employer witness to that, and I believe it was either Ms. Holmes or Mr. Locken who testified that even if the truck was low on hydraulic fluid, all that would mean is that the lowering and raising mechanism for the jump box would be slower, if anything. It would not cause the box to go up on its own. From my very shaky and rudimentary grasp on physics, my understanding also is that hydraulic fluid, if it's low, it works with pressure. So if pressure is being distributed throughout the fluid, that's what makes the box move up and down. And if there's less fluid and therefore less pressure, there would be less movement, not more, and certainly not spontaneous, unexpected movement of the kind that Mr. Butler describes. So for all of these reasons, Your Honors, we would ask that the court affirm the ULJ's decision. There is no error that requires reversal or remand in this case. The admission of the Alford plea, while erroneous, was not prejudicial to Mr. Butler because there is sufficient other evidence in the record to support all of the findings of fact. And with that, I will rest unless there are questions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, thank you. Rebuttal?
Just briefly, Your Honors, I didn't have an opportunity to really get to that question of the consideration of the Alford plea in the ALJ's final decision, and I do think that is error. not only error of law, but it taints fatally the her.
Counsel, what does the record reflect in terms of who offered the Alford plea and the record of conviction into evidence? Because my reading was that it was you.
We asked her to take judicial notice because it was a, he had been ticketed. We asked her to take judicial notice at the first hearing of his entry of the Alford plea to ensure that she understood that he wasn't admitting to anything in open court.
Well, that's the part I'm confused about. So you asked the judge to take judicial notice of the Alford plea and the record of conviction because why?
Well, it had already been entered into the record that he had been ticketed.
There have been comments by witnesses
right.
that there had been a ticket
right.
issued. And so...
So we just wanted to make the record complete, give, you know, that she had an opportunity, if she wished to do so, to check on that record, public record of his entry.
And the reason it confused me is because we do have a very specific statute in Minnesota that says that such things are not admissible in evidence in a civil proceeding. So I you know, since it came from you and not from Deed in particular, so I'm just confused by that,
I'm
the employer.
Just trying to point out to her that it was an Alford plea primarily, that he wasn't.
And that he didn't acknowledge
any wrongdoing.
Right.
And then of course, the findings, as pointed out by counsel for the department respondent, the statute only has two elements. One is that he was driving, which isn't in dispute. Number two is that the vehicle he was driving had a height of over 13 feet 6 inches, which isn't in dispute. When he hit the bridge, the height of that vehicle. The question is, how did the height of that vehicle extend
but
to 13
But that's not the
feet?
Only question, and I asked that to you earlier. It's not just how did the box get up, but it's why didn't Mr. Butler realize that the box was up at some point before he ran into the overpass? Because he's in control of the vehicle, right?
He testified in both. Well, first of all, it's my understanding and our contention that all of the evidence from all of the hearings has to be considered when the ALJ makes her final determination. We understand, and if I misspoke in my brief, I apologize. We understand that she sets aside those findings after the first, when she grants a second hearing. But all of the evidence is still before her. The evidence is unclear. Well, first of all, the evidence is, at least the testimony of Mr. Butler, is that this was a very bumpy road. You know, he was driving a large dump truck, trying to keep it on the road, and there was a lot of noise because of the bumpiness. He says he looked in his rearview mirrors. There's no testimony other, again, than the testimony, I believe, of the mechanic that he couldn't have looked in his rearview mirrors because he would have seen, you know, either the line going down or the box. There's no testimony as to how he would see the box in his rearview mirrors. It's entirely possible that he wouldn't see the box in his rearview mirrors, that they would be pointed more outwards to see traffic on and obstacles on either side. So we don't have conclusive evidence that he would have seen the box up while he's driving down the road, with the exception of the testimony of the mechanic, who, again, is not, in our opinion, not a disinterested witness. There was comments made by counsel for the respondent that the prior accident should be taken into consideration or can be taken into consideration in the ALJ's decision. And I would argue strenuously that it can't. There's no evidence.
Are you talking about the May accident?
The May accident. There's no.
I actually did not hear that argument or see that in the briefs. At the
well, I thought she just made that in her oral arguments. But I don't think, because there's no evidence that he was at fault. The evidence, I think the overwhelming evidence, is that he was directed by an employee.
And it definitely
to back
is not,
up.
The May accident is not a basis for the ULJ's decision.
I wanted to clarify that, mm-hmm. Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, again, the purpose of these administrative hearings is to gather evidence, and the duty, as enunciated in several cases, one of which Cordes v. Heartland Midwest LLC is cited in our brief, it's the duty of the ALJ to develop the evidentiary record. And we think that remanding this case to have further evidence produced as to the cause of the box being elevated is in furtherance of that duty to develop the evidentiary record completely. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your briefing and arguments. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the court's oral calendar this morning. Thank you.